evening on Bookends is Dr. Howard Halpern, author of The Cutting Loose, An Adult Guide to Coming to Terms with Your Parents. It's a book aimed not at adolescents or the young, but people of all ages who are caught in a set pattern of role-playing with their parents and who are interested in breaking out of that pattern. Dr. Halpern is a clinical psychologist who has practiced psychotherapy in New York City for over 20 years. Welcome to our program.
It's nice to be here.
Well, I guess perhaps it would be good to start with, tell us about your book.
Well, you know, you said a lot in just introducing it. It's a kind of guidebook on for adults on the kind of problems that you run into with your parents. You know, there's been so much written about parents and little children and parents and teenagers that it's rather amazing to me that no one before had written a book on the relationship between adults and their parents. It grew out of a number of things. It grew largely out of my practice as a psychotherapist when I began to notice that when we were talking about parents, we weren't only talking about things that happened with your parents when you were a little kid or when you were an adolescent, which is common to all psychotherapy to trace the roots of things. But we were talking about problems today, last week, day before yesterday. Wow. People were saying things to me like, every time I call my mother, she asks, how come I don't call? Or, you know, my parents are interfering with my life, and I don't know how to get them to stop. When I try to stop them, they're hurt, or they're angry, or something of that sort. People recognizing that they're still very hung up on trying to get their parents' approval, even though they're old enough to have children of their own. And people terrified of their parents' disapproval or anger. So I began to take this all in. I began to look around me and see that it wasn't just my patient population that this was true of, but that friends, relatives, acquaintances, colleagues, myself, all of us had some kind of problems in relation to parents. And that's when I decided, well, I want to do a book that may at least help clarify some of the issues and point in the direction to some solutions.
What are some of the major problems people have with their parents?
Well, I think that while they fall into different categories, they have certain things in common. I tend to feel that when we are adults and are still having trouble with our parents, that the part of our parent that we're having trouble with is the little child in them.
I want to ask you to explain that term.
Right. Well, the idea is not new with me, but I've developed it in relation to this particular problem. We all have a little child, an inner child inside of us. Some of it is a very delightful part of us. It's the part that we like to take to a party when we, you know, laugh and play, or to a ball game when we scream our heads off, or when we play ball. But there's another part of the child that is still in us that may not be so delightful. And that's the part that may still have some of the insecurity, some of the fears, some of the inadequacy feelings, some of the dependency that is common to all children. It's part of being a child. And if it still clings in us, as it almost always does to some degree or another, it can cause difficulties. Now, if it's there in our parents, and it is, and if it's there in a large degree in them, that needy little child in them is going to not want us to grow up too strong, too independent, because that needy little child is afraid of being abandoned.
So our parents are afraid of losing us, just as a child is afraid of losing his parents.
Exactly. That to some degree, a parent is afraid of losing us, afraid that our growth is going to mean abandonment. Mm-hmm. And that part of the parent then is mobilized to undercut that growth. Now, all parents differ, and they differ in several ways. They differ in how big a part of them that child part is. Some parents, it's a very minor part, and the more mature parenting part is much bigger, and there aren't many problems that arise from it. Other parents are big kids, you know, and that may be a very large part of it. And their offspring are bound to have a lot, you know, many difficulties about it. Not only do parents differ as far as how much of them is this dependent, clinging, controlling child, but they also differ in the kind of techniques or maneuvers that that child and them will use to try to hold on to their offspring. So that one parent may try to make the child feel terribly guilty. Another may try to make the child feel scared of their anger, of the parent's anger. Another may try to make the child feel just ashamed, as if they've done something terrible, and so on. And all of these techniques, the child gets caught up in them, and they get caught up in what I call in the book a song and dance, between the inner child of the parent and the inner child of the offspring. Mm-hmm. I call it a song and dance because it's just repeated over and over again. It's almost rhythmic. It's almost ritualistic. You can predict it. And it can keep on going on forever unless someone tries to, unless someone's successful at breaking that.
How does that song and dance begin?
It begins really from child's earliest days. For example, if the child's part in the mother needs to keep the offspring very close, and let's say she's what I call in the book Mama the Martyr. She uses guilt provocation as her main technique of controlling. Then right from the beginning, she might say to the child, oh, you got sick on me again, you know. Now I have to stay in all day because you got a cold, and you got a cold because you went out with a sweater when I told you not to, and so on. Or right from their early days, they may say things like, you're putting gray hairs in my head, or even you're driving nails into my coffin, that kind of thing. Now, when they've started that, when you're really small, when you're just a little kid, it creates a very vulnerable soft spot in you to that sort of thing. The little child feels terrible. The little child feels, literally, I'm killing mother, I'm hurting mother. And as we grow older, that inner child remains in us. If our parent continues to use, let's say, that guilt provocation I was just talking about, it strikes that note in us and we feel just awful. And even when we begin to know better, even when we begin to see it as a maneuver, it's still sometimes very difficult to stop because our emotions are so caught up in it. We're really programmed at that point. We have to get unprogrammed from that guilty reaction.
Does the parent do that knowingly? Is it deliberate, and is there a conflict? Is the parent is there a conflict in what the parent might be saying one time and saying another time?
Oh, very definitely. Very definitely to the last part about the conflict. As to whether it's deliberate or knowing, I think that differs from person to person. I think that very often it isn't. Very often it's just so automatic for the parent to respond that way, usually because that parent's own parent responded that way. So they were trained to be guilt-provoking or, you know, to control the child. And it gets passed on from generation to generation. And it gets passed on the way that, as I said, makes it very automatic and usually subconscious rather than deliberate. Now, sometimes parents can use it very deliberately when you try something and you see that it really works.
Uh-huh.
Then you might try it over and over again. So the answer to that question is, I think that it doesn't have to be conscious and very often isn't. Now, the other part of what you asked was, do the parents give different messages at different times? And they sure do. And not only different messages at different times, they sometimes give different messages at the same time, which really becomes confusing for the child. I'll tell you now a story that I mentioned in the book, but what I'll add to it now is that it was this incident that really was the, like, final final thing that decided me on writing this book. I'd had it in my mind a long time. You know, that feeling that adults needed some kind of guidebook, too, in dealing with their parents. But there was an incident where I was helping a young woman that I knew move into a new apartment. And her mother was there to help also. And the movers had just deposited a whole lot of furniture. And we were all working really hard, as you do in that kind of situation. There's so much to do. And the mother kept saying to the daughter, you look so exhausted, you look so tired, why don't you go down, why don't you lie down and rest for a while? And a couple of hours later, the daughter said, you know, Mom, you're right, I'm really pooped, I'm going to go take a little nap. And she went inside, and every couple of minutes, mother kept popping in and saying, where should I put this, where should I put that? Hey, why did you move this? You know, do you really need it? Why don't we throw it out? That kind of thing. And after a while, the daughter said, look, Mom, you told me to go in and lie down and rest, and yet you keep coming in every 2 or 3 minutes and disturbing me. And the mother was very angry, and she walked out, and she called out over her shoulder, well, I don't see how you can rest with the apartment in such a mess. So there's a double message. And I took a look at this young woman's face, and it's hard to describe the expression on it. She looked confused, enraged, bewildered. And I said, oh, I really do have to write that book, you know, because this is going on all the time. So that's one example of a double message. But the more usual type of double message is a message such as, I want you to be strong and independent, so you better do what I say. Now, see, you hear that all in one sentence? Now, the first part of that message, if it's real, and it often is, I want you to be strong and independent, is coming from the mature parenting part of the parent. Because I think every parent knows that their job is ultimately to help the child not need them anymore. Mm-hmm. Parent knows that their job is to help the kid stand on his or her own 2 feet, make it on their own. Parent knows that the parent's not going to be around forever. Mm-hmm. And that's what good parenting is all about. So I want you to be strong and independent comes from that part. But then there's that inner child I was talking of before that's afraid of that very growth on the part of the offspring. And so that inner child says, so you better do what I say. In other words, recognize that you're still a kid, I'm the boss around here. And this kind of thing, a sentence could be sometimes said to a 10-year-old, or a 20-year-old, or a 30-year-old, or a 50-year-old, you know, this is the issue. Sometimes it's not said as blatantly as that. It's sometimes more subtle, but those double messages, particularly the, you know, grow up,
but don't grow up,
or be successful, but not so successful that you're going to get into a world I don't understand and have no room for me or time for me. That kind of double message is very often there.
Mm-hmm. How can you recognize if you're having a problem with your parent?
That's a good question. I think that there are certain things that you can look for. First of all, by the way, most people are having a problem with their parents do know it. If they at all just try to be honest with themselves, they know it. I mean, some people really know it, complain about it all the time, are very distraught about it. But there are certain things you can look for. I mean, there are certain questions you can ask yourself. Things like, do I call my parents more often than I really'd like to? Because if I don't, they make me feel like I'm doing something wrong. Do I see them more often than I really would like to for the same reasons? In some of the major and minor decisions of my life, am I afraid to follow my own inclinations if those would be different than my parents' expectations of me? Am I afraid that they're going to disapprove? And would that disapproval be so upsetting to me that I'd rather avoid it and, okay, I'll take the easy way out and I'll do it the way they want me to do it? Getting in touch with your feelings when you visit them or are with them is very important. To ask yourself, well, when I leave them, do I feel good? Do I feel very uptight and nervous? Do I run to pick up a cigarette or run to the nearest bar when I leave them or whatever? Do I have a headache? you know, what are the feelings that relating to them generates in me? So there are many kinds of things like that that we can look for to see if we're having a problem.
The next question is, what should the offspring do? Move 1,000 miles away? Does that help matters, or you know, is that the solution to the problem?
No, it rarely is. Although I have to say this, that for some people who've tried lots of other things, that sometimes actually moving away geographically, while it doesn't solve it, it makes the possibility of solution easier. Just that not having that frequent contact, not having those buttons pushed as often, those guilt buttons or fear buttons or anger buttons or whatever, gives them a chance to develop a certain self-sufficiency, a self-reliance, to grow up, to feel independent, and be able to approach their parents from that position more, and gives their parents an opportunity to be without that child on a regular sort of basis, and maybe for the inner child and the parent to grow up a little and be able to accept the child, their offspring, as an adult. But that moving away doesn't guarantee it. As I say, it can make it easier, but by no means guarantees it. No, I think that it's a much harder process than that, than simply getting in a car and going somewhere else can solve. And there are several steps that are involved. One of them we were just talking about a moment ago, recognizing that you're in a song and dance with them, that the child in you is hooked into the child in them in some way that's really limits your world and limits your freedom to be who you are. Once you've recognized that, I think it's very helpful to recognize that the part of your parent that you're hooked into is that child. For example, suppose you've been terrified of father's disapproval all your life. When you were very young, maybe he thundered and spanked you and sent you to your room, and he may have been, let's say, tyrannical kind of father. I call in the book Daddy the Despot. And right, D.D. And he, D.D. may have you pretty scared, and you've grown older, and even though he no longer is going to spank you or send you to your room, when he thunders, you still feel, you still cringe. And when you have something to tell him that you know is going to upset him, like you're changing your career to something that he wouldn't approve of, or you're marrying someone that he wouldn't approve of, you can go through all kinds of terrible anxiety feelings beforehand. Now, suppose, though, you begin to see that what you've been afraid of all the time is a little kid inside Daddy. And what do I mean by that in this case? I mean that a mature man has really no need to frighten his kid. A mature man doesn't treat his kid as a possession doesn't need to, you know, thunder around that much. But if we see that what's going on is that inside Daddy there's a brat. There's a brat who may have been the playground bully when he was a kid, who has always wanted things his way, and that I've often asked people to visualize him in terms of a 3 or 4 or 5 year old sitting on a huge throne that's much too big for him, with a crown on his head that's much too big for him, so it's sort of slipping over his eyes, and holding a scepter that's really a pinwheel, and get that image of him, you know, then piping, listen to me, I'm the big man around here. You know, and if you get that image of the kid within father, you can't be very afraid of him anymore. You know, he's not as formidable, and he becomes easier to deal with. And you can have some compassion for that guy who is feeling like he still has to throw his weight around. You don't have to get into any fights with him, but it's a matter of then being able to just consistently assert that now this is the way you need it to be. This is in your own best interest. And as I say, if you see him as that kid, you'll be less afraid to do it. So, as I say, the first step is recognizing that you're in a song and dance. The second step would be recognizing the child within the parent. Third step is recognizing that it's the child within you that's still responding as if you're still a little helpless nothing. You're still a helpless little baby, while the truth is that you're an adult who has probably accomplished a lot and doing a lot in the world. So you're recognizing that that child in you is still responding in the old way. And the fourth step is that even after you've seen all this, change is still difficult to come by. That you don't just see it all, at least usually you don't just see it all and then say, aha, now it's no longer a problem. Uh-huh. You still have to work on it. You have to work on it, and particularly you have to have the courage to go through that psychological pain that you're going to have when you start getting out of the song and dance. In other words, if you stop, say, going along with a guilt trip, you're going to go through some guilt. There's no two ways about it. And you're going to have to just have the courage to go through it again and again and again, maybe each time a little less disturbing, a little less painful. Or if you've been reacting with fear about the disapproval, you're going to have to live with that fear and go through it again and again until it becomes less frightening. There's no easy way, but it can definitely be done. And I'd say those are the major steps in accomplishing it.
The individual just has to continue to assert what he feels is best for himself.
That's right. And at the same time, have a kind of compassion for that part of the parent that's going to be upset about your breaking away. Because, parents' lot is not easy at all. And, there is that child in them that's afraid of losing you. I experience it with my own children. I have two daughters, 15 and 11, and when I see them taking certain steps, going away on trips by themselves or, with some friends and so on, I feel that pang of a certain loss when I become aware that they're doing things and having experiences now that I will not know about, probably will never know about, that this is their own private affair. I feel that sense of loss. I like it when they're kind of compassionate to me and nice to me when I'm going through that. And I think so it's a two-step, two-part thing, really. And one is to assert your own way, be firm about that. But be a compassionate toward the part of your parent that may not be ready yet to have you do that, and that's going to suffer from it.
What will be the parent's reaction? That will vary. I know you're
hearing. Yeah, right.
Are you going to modify your parent's behavior, or are they just going to continue asserting that little child?
Yeah. Now that is a good question, because the most common thing that I see is that initially, when you begin to change, the parents, in a sense, get worse. If they're guilt provokers, they'll become more guilt provoking. If they're tyrannical, they'll yell and scream more about it. But if you stick by your guns, what begins to happen in the great majority of times is that they begin to see that you mean business, accept the reality of it, and then begin to try to rebuild the relationship or reform it, really, on a more adult-to-adult level. So it usually goes through that stage of first getting worse and then getting better. Now, there are a few parents, a smaller percentage, who cannot make that shift. They are inflexible. They're stuck in where they are. They harden into a more adversary position with each change. Mm-hmm. And when you have parents like that, after a while, it really may be necessary to give up. And it may be necessary to, in a sense, terminate any meaningful relationship with them. I mean, you may go through the obligatory, birthday card and occasional visit and occasional holiday present or whatever. But really, you may have to give up on having anything more with them.
What are the major types of songs and dances that we play with our parents?
Well, mentioned a couple of them. One of them is, well, there are a couple of types, really, that you play with the martyred mother. One of them might be the placating one. Oh, gee, Mom, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'll try to come over and visit tomorrow. And the only reason I didn't yesterday was I had this terrible headache myself, you know.
Ah, yes.
Another way of responding to a song and dance with martyred mother may be a defiant one. Really get angry. You're trying to boss me around. You're trying to control me. You're pulling that guilt trip again, and I won't stand for it. It leads to a conflict, and maybe a couple of days later, your guilt is built up, and you're called up, and you're back in the same thing again. So that, you know, either whether it's compliant or defiant, they're both two sides of the same coin.
Yeah,
it's still
you're playing their game.
It's still, yeah, the kid and you are responding, and it's responding to the kid and them. The way out would be to say in that instance, well, I'm sorry, Mom, no, I'm not calling as often as you'd like, but I really have a lot of things to take care of, and I want you to know that just because I don't call as often as you'd like doesn't mean I don't care. I love you very much. It's just that I have a busy life. In other words, you reassure the little child, stay on your own ground. That's one, that's a couple of types with the martyred mother. With the despotic daddy, all kinds of songs and dances. There's one where you can really get into a defiant thing with him and battles every single day, every single night when you're living at home. That may go on as a chronic sort of thing, and after you move out and have a life of your own, it still can be a very hostile confrontation. Another can be to become very submissive. You're scared of him, and you give in, and you're never really who you really are. You're just always giving in to daddy and doing things his way, and maybe entering his business, or the, you know, even though you don't want to. Mm-hmm. If you want to, that's another story.
Yeah.
But entering his business because he wants you to, or choosing a certain career because he wants it, getting married to a certain person because he thinks that person's great for you, and so on. That would be another type of song and dance. Or you might, as some people do, identify with this despotic daddy, and you become, you know, just like him, and chip off the old block kind of thing, but you're still not really being who you are. It's just you're following the old prescription. If you can't fight him, join him, you know. So these are some of the songs and dances. There are songs and dances that the moralizing or moralistic parent also
when the saints come marching in.
Yeah, that's that, right, yes. When the saints go marching in, there are some parents who really believe they're saints in the sense that they think that they know the rights and wrongs about everything, and it could be from really big ethical life and death issues or sexual morality or so on to the tiniest thing as to what kind of clothes you should wear, and what color jacket you ought to wear with what pants, or what shoes with what dress. And they are certain that they're right.
Yeah.
And not only that they're right, but that they're in touch with some absolute right, you know, that's like a given in the universe. So therefore, if you don't agree with them, or if you do something other than that, you're transgressing against some absolute rule or absolute code, and that you ought to be terribly ashamed of yourself, and you're bringing disgrace on them, and so on. And you can get into many songs and dances with them that, again, might be going along with their way of seeing things and blinding yourself to all kinds of alternatives, or catching a glimpse that there are other alternatives and going through a whole process of trying to make them see it and change them, make them see it differently. So there are many kinds. And by the way, when I said that, make them see it differently, change them, there's one thing that I'd want to emphasize that runs through all of what we're talking about, and that is that as soon as our aim becomes trying to change our parents, we get caught right up in another song and dance.
Oh.
We can't change anyone. Changing ourselves is rough enough. Changing other people is darn near impossible. In psychotherapy, we have a rough time changing people, and these are people who are there to be changed, mm-hmm. you know, who want to go through these changes. So if your aim is to change your parents, you're going to fail at it. You'll just be in another song and dance. The only end of the song and dance that you can change is your own. And if you successfully change that, your reaction, then there is some chance that as a byproduct of that, your parents are going to change too. But if you aim directly at changing them, it's not going to work.
Uh-huh. I think that's we've run out of time, and that's a very good way, I think, to end this discussion. I want to thank you very much. Our guest has been Dr. Howard Halpern, author of Cutting Loose.